Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively in Catonsville today. Don Mohler, man, I have waited a long time.
Back. Here we go.
I have waited a long time to come to Paradise, Maryland here, right? Paradise is across the bridge, though, right?
Across the bridge, little, you know, a mile down the road, not very far.
Well, the sign says Paradise. It's people say absolutely. You're in Catonsville, but
when you come to Catonsville, you get a little paradise.
Well, I got a guy here that thinks everywhere is paradise, right?
Yes, we're introducing the good doctor to a whole new eating place.
Yes,
today.
It is. It's a whole new eating place and plenty of refreshments. In my tradition, we call it communion.
Well, we're going to break bread. There's no doubt about that. We're going to break bread today. Don, I've known the Reverend's work through different people, and I've never met you.
So wow.
Some of my favorite guests, like Chris Van Hollen.
Oh, yes.
Different people that I'd never met when I sit next to them. UMBC, we you know, for us and you being here today.
At Jennings Cafe.
Yes. Where we're doing, you know, I've seen your work, and a lot of times you come to me on television after tragedy, and I think that's very, very unfortunate, you know,
that's
when the media seeks you out to say, we have another tragedy. Do you want to talk about it, Reverend? And I think that's unfortunate, and I want to change that.
Well, I'm with you on that. I think there's so much positive news. I think there's so amazing things that are happening. You know, it's unfortunate that this kind of eyewitness news format has sought to glorify and sensationalize violence and trauma and tragedy as a way of a marketing tool, but I think positive news is good news.
Well, and it's so important, Reverend Hathaway. The reason that you're such an important voice, and we're going to talk over the next 45 minutes or so about so many important issues facing our city. But one of the things that Nestor said from the beginning was that he wanted to talk with really smart people, not only elected officials, but community leaders, faith-based leaders who are making a difference. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm struck by is if you can share, folks, not everybody might know your background. So how does little Al Hathaway become Reverend Al Hathaway?
Wow, that is kind of profound. And I have to really take it to the fact that I'm a child of the 50s. I was born in 51. So you're talking about I've had a long arc in terms of seeing Baltimore City. I was actually born in the block of the church in which I serve, the 1200 block of Drill Avenue. And that was a historic and a significant place as I grew up. One of my childhood friends was George Mitchell, who's the youngest son of Clarence and Juanita Mitchell. So they lived in the block right in the 1300 block. Our church was always the epicenter of a lot of the social and political and communal activity. So I grew up in that. So here I am, a young kid, growing up in the city, and they tell me, hey, take this sign, and we're going to go pick it.
You were 12 years old, Dr. King, in the 60s,
and
17 during the riots.
Sure.
I mean, I was born in 68, so
right.
you guys have a different experience than I do. It's something I read about. It's something you live through.
So somebody says, they give you a sign.
They give me a sign.
Continue with that.
They give me a sign. They say, hey, come on, we're going to go pick it because there's a real estate owner that is taking advantage of people in the African-American community. So my real first experience was picketing what we now know as Gold Seeker.
Yep. How old?
I was about now 10.
10, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And so this real experience comes, and then coming behind that is now you got to keep in mind now, this is like 61. Now we're talking about 62. Wow, 63 was epic. 63, you have to realize that our church became the place where people coming from the South going to the March on Washington, that's where they stay. But prior to that, and sometimes people don't realize this.
So you're 12 years old, and you're meeting people
from all coming to your congregation. Exactly. But prior to that, Reverend Dobson led, along with other clergy leaders, led the desegregation of Gwin Oak Park. And so Gwin Oak Park, people don't realize that was prior to the August March on Washington in 63. This was June. And so June and July, here you had this activism going on in Baltimore. Here we are, young kids, you know, basically warm bodies, looking for the opportunity to go and be able to go to Gwin Oak Park. And they desegregated Glen Oak Park. They're about in July of 63. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the Great March on Washington in August of 63. I never forget, as a young child, my going into Glen Oak Park, and I got to ride on the merry-go-round. And the merry-go-round, of course, had a horse on it, and you imagine you were Roy Rogers and all the kind of Western figures, and that was exciting. Then, fast-forwarding years, I'm taking my children on the Washington Mall in Washington, D.C., and there is that same merry-go-round.
Now,
from Glen Oak Park is on the mall in Washington, D.C., as a monument to the desegregation movement, where you basically had, what happened was, you had these railroad systems that basically had terminal lines, and at the end of those lines, they got rights, and then of those rights, they built housing, built amusement parks, and this just talked about how this event really broke that that barrier.
Well, I mean, I feel like we had a history lesson. I mean, Glen Oak, my mother went there to the amusement park. And Don, that's of your era as well.
Well,
right?
It's, you know, what a history. And again, what we want Baltimore Positive to be is to people understand from the past, be able to apply it to the future. When the Reverend talked about, I'm writing notes as quickly
you
as I can write them.
63, I'm thinking Kennedy got shot a couple months later.
Incredible year. Oh, yes. And when he mentioned the whole blockbusting scandal, and I'm going to ask you to, I want to talk about blockbusting, I want to talk about Glen Oak, I want to talk about the march. Blockbusting, to me, very, very real. It's funny, we're similar ages.
Right.
I spent, as I've mentioned on this show before, a fair amount of my young life at 612 Allendale Street, just down the street from Edmondson Village.
Right,
you just go down the theater that way, cut through the alley, go to St. Bernadette's, up the street the other way.
Same period of time, right?
Exactly the same period of time. And as a matter of fact, my aunt and uncle, who loved 612 Allendale Street, and when we talked about it one day down at Fadley's, Nestor, I actually said to myself, you know what, because we had talked about Allendale Street, I'm going to ride home that way. And I rode back up and I parked in front of 612 Allendale Street, and I thought of all the memories. But tell educate people what Goldsecker and blockbusting was doing to the city, how it was tearing people apart. And I remember my aunt and uncle being just really exploited at that period of time as well.
Yeah, it was really, if you really think about, and again, I'm really blessed that Union Baptist Church itself is 163 years old. So I have a lens by being the 10th pastor of that to see this arc of freedom and this arc of struggle through that lens. And then also being growing up inside of the really crucible of the church, I've been a participant. And one of the challenges that we've had in Baltimore City has been we've always been the epic center of racial injustice and racial freedom. I mean, there's always been that dynamic that has gone on in our city. And when you think in terms of the systematic the systematic change in racial configuration of communities was basically done by fear. Here comes someone different that's going to come into your community. Therefore, you who have lived here before, you flee because you fear.
I remember specifically, Reverend, talk to this. I can remember, you know, I'm a little kid, so I'm on the periphery of the discussion. I'm in the other room, but I hear, and it was actually my mom's aunt and uncle, so it's my great aunt and uncle, who are up in age, who are now, they're not sure what's happening. My great uncle was a city fireman forever. And here are these realtors in their dining room area saying, just what you said, you better get out of here.
That's right.
You better take this offer now because, quote unquote, they're coming.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really tragic because there has always been similarity of values. When you think in terms of when I grew up in the 1200 block of Drill Avenue, a very wholesome community. I looked across the street, there was a doctor. I looked down the street, there were lawyers. I had a religious experience where there was a whole conglomerate of the intelligentsia of Baltimore City. And then you get 1955, 1956, 57, you start to get movement. So now we move out of this kind of segregated Upton area, and now our family moves to Shipley Hill. Shipley Hill was the area in Baltimore, which was off of Baltimore and Frankentown Road, where you would have now mangers that would bring the pigs in, and mm-hmm. you would get the meat factory and all of this. That's where we moved to. And we were the first family to integrate the 2500 block of Holland Street.
Okay, that's Jackie wow. Robinson stuff.
Yes, it is.
That wasn't easy, right?
No, it wasn't
easy. You were the first African-American family on the street?
Right, on that street. On that street. Well, and
talk about that experience.
Well, the fortunate thing was that we being first was the first week. Here comes another family that was first, that was second in the second week. So then you kind of had some commonality. But I had a friend. I never forget. I was out playing. I had a friend, and Timmy, I remember his name. He was a white young kid, and we would play on the front. And
you were new in the neighborhood.
I was new in the neighborhood.
How old were you?
Oh, I'm 7 years old.
Oh, this is 58?
58, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'm playing in the neighborhood, playing in the community, got Timmy as a friend, and I'll never forget that Timmy's parents pulled him away and said that we're going to move. And this was my first real loss of a friend who was Timmy. And I never knew what the reason was. I never knew, understood. All I knew that Timmy left, and here comes other families that were African-American families moving into the community. One of the real challenges was, and this is really something amazing about Baltimore City, was that we when I went to school, I went to elementary school. It was the Betsy Ross. Can you imagine that? Betsy Ross Elementary School. Betsy Ross Elementary School was just south of Frederick Avenue. Right, but you had to go there in groups because there would be racial tension as you, as an African American young kid, we elementary school kids going to school and being there. We had to go in literally groups, go in and come back. The school system did not want that tension in Southeast Baltimore, and what they did was they fast tracked building a school that was for African Americans on Warwick Avenue. Fast tracked it. So we had a brand new school, right? Here you had Betsy Ross was an old school. We had a brand new school. I didn't realize at that time it was only African Americans in
to
the school.
To segregate.
They segregated the school.
And isn't it interesting that here we are today,
yes,
2019, and we still have issues,
yes, it is,
of schools. Schools in many ways are more segregated today,
yes, they are,
than they were back then.
Well, right. Don, I would say to you, I met you in 1982. Don Don was okay. my high school guidance counselor.
We'll come up to 82.
Well, up to 82. So I entered elementary school in 73, and I'm from Colgate East Point. We just got rid of Colgate Elementary. It was 100 years old. Johnny O came over. I never met a black child. There was never a black child in my elementary school.
Wow.
There was never a black child in my middle school.
Wow.
The first time I ever had anyone African-American in a class. I had teachers. My second grade teacher was African-American.
Yes. Right.
My fourth grade teacher was African-American. But
think about that. You never had an African-American in your class.
Yeah. And I never asked why until 2005, probably.
Right.
And in my high school, and Don, you A lunch, B lunch, C lunch, and Dundalk High, he was the guidance counselor. All of the African-American kids sat in one corner because they were all from Turner Station.
Right.
They all knew each other.
That's right.
And none of us knew them.
Yeah.
Well, it's so interesting. Let's jump back again to this period you're talking about, Reverend, in the 60s. Right now, just this week, I started to read a book about the relationship between Don Shula, legendary Colt coach, and Johnny Unitas.
Right.
And it has a lot of the history of the early Colts, particularly in the 60s.
Right.
And it has chapters on the racism in Baltimore and throughout the United States in the NFL and how it affected the great players like Lenny Moore and Jim Parker
and
Big Daddy Lipscomb, who ended up basically dead as a result and in a constant depression because of those issues.
Yeah.
So
Lenny Moore has spoken to that
times. And it's interesting, they talk about the fondness that many white players have when they recall their training camp days at Western Maryland College in Westminster's.
Yeah.
And as Lenny Moore and others would say, you were in a different Westminster.
That's right. That's true.
Than I was.
Well, just think about it. I tell you about Betsy Ross. Then we created a segregated school, 60. But then I go to junior high school. And I go to junior high school, and I'm now a minority student in a white school. And that is Gwynns Falls Park which is then junior high school. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't have middle schools at that time. That was on Hilton Avenue, Hilton, right above.
Exactly Kate. Where it is, right.
Now I want to tell you about this, because this just astounds me now when I think about it. So sitting to my left, so we had accelerated classes. I've been 701, and so we're supposedly to be very bright and intelligent young people. So sitting to my left is Elijah Cummings.
Wow. Right?
Sitting to my left is Elijah Cummings.
How did he turn out? What happened to him?
You know what? It was amazing about him.
Thanks for the turnout.
Oh, he did okay, didn't he?
It was amazing about him was that he always had a zest and a eagerness for learning. So you always could count on him to have his homework. You could always count on him.
He was the guy you were going to cheat off.
Yeah. If you wanted to look over somebody's shoulder,
it was
Elijah Cummings, you know. And then just as I'm getting ready to say, my other colleague on the other side, I got to tell you about my other friend. Next to me, my name is Hathaway. So next to me was Frank Hatfield. Frank Hatfield was a white young man. He was smart. But, of course, because his name was Hatfield, you had to bring up Hatfield and McCoys. So we would continue an ongoing battle and a laugh around this. And then on my other side was a gentleman who, Gregory Kane.
Sure.
So if you remember Gregory Kane.
Famous Sun columnist.
Right. Gregory Kane was, so this is a seventh grade class of amazingly bright preschool. Our social studies teacher was Dr. Samuel L. Banks. And Dr. Samuel Banks was a noted educator. So here he is. He brings these young minds. He challenges us. He did something very significant in junior high school. The question was, now you got to think, keep in mind that we're talking about 63, you're talking about President Kennedy, you're talking about all of these things going on. And his question to us was, you are free. How do you know that you were free? This is a social studies teacher. And we had to then learn all of the civil rights cases that led to the breakdown of racial bias and
so
racial.
So you're looking
justice.
At Brown versus Board of
versus
Education,
Ford, Plessy versus Ferguson. You know, we went through all of that. And that was our learning. Of course, now Elijah took it to heart,
right,
and pursued it as a legal career. I took it to heart and pursued it as a sense of justice. And so the impact of education is paramount. And so one of the things that really concerns me now is that you have students going through schools and they're not learning any real practical skills. They're not learning any real social skills that will equip them to be citizens in a broader society. And I think that is tragic. But I was blessed. Now, keep in mind now, I'm there at 63, 66, 64, 65, 66.
I mean, this is...
Can you think
is,
about that period of time in terms of our history?
It's actually... Entire courses
yes.
in colleges and university
exactly.
address that 5, 6, 7 year period.
Right.
I mean, it you say so much,
and
going
it means
on.
Something different as a student who's a white student versus right. a student of color. I would think the way it's taught, the way it's perceived, what your parents told you about, what your experience would be about. I mean, I grew up in a segregated area, and it took right. me until I was 40 years old to figure it out.
Well,
like literally, that's how. Blind yeah. you can be, and whether that's white privilege or whatever they call it today, you know, that's what it is.
Well,
you know?
I remember the Reverend talks about, you talk about going to Gwin Oak.
Right.
Other friends of mine that I've known over the years, when I sit down and talk with African-American contemporaries, they talk about that experience of seeing that roller coaster
for
the first time. And,
right.
and obviously, you mentioned the white privilege part, Nestor. I'm thinking back. I never gave it a second thought when I was 11 or 12.
That you were allowed to go places.
That I was allowed to go there
right.
and other children
were not.
Who could not. And actually, my wife is reading that famous book right now. Mm. Her book club is doing that. Not in my neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Antonio Patelli.
Patelli. I mean, yeah. the seminal work,
he
right?
Has, he captures it.
On housing segregation and the segregation in Baltimore. And almost every night, she'll say to me, I just read another section. I
right.
can't believe it. And then
right.
last night, she said, and she has a lot of close Jewish friends. And she'll go, my gosh, it was African Americans, it was Jewish people. I mean, it was one segregated section after
another.
But
here's the thing, though. I would suggest to you that where people may look at that and see that as a deficit, we just saw it as difference. And as my growing up, I did not see that as a weakness. I saw it as strength because we were strongly enforced with a Afrocentric sense of who you are. And there you got a religious center of activism. Now I've got these amazing educators that were impacting me. So you knew that you were a person and you knew that you could compete. You didn't go and bear any kind of hurt or harm towards another person. You knew that you had to make your way. So let me tell you. So I go through this. And keep in mind, this is important. And y'all done pricked something. I shouldn't tell you all of this.
Good. But now I want you to tell me.
So 66, here we are. And here's this class from Gwynns Falls Junior High goes to Baltimore City College. And we go to a amazing school that in this school now, you had to now, as your conversational language, had to be Latin. So we had to now learn Latin as our conversational language. And then we had to also have two other languages. So I took French and took Spanish. Now, keep in mind now, now you're talking about 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, with these sciences, trigonometry, calculus, with this art and culture and sports.
Now, how are you going to find time for girls in sports with all this going on?
Well, the beauty about City at that time was that we had the blessing of Eastern High School right across the street.
Was George Young teaching there then?
Yeah, George Young was there.
I pulled out an old tape of George Young this summer.
Just think about a George Young as a history teacher who is now the coach of your football team, who is so brilliant that he goes directly to the NFL.
Well, was Dutch, and has great success.
Was Dutch there at the same time?
Yes.
Dutch was, because Dutch talked about, he talked about his relationship with George Young.
Yeah. So here you have now you've got this broad array of progressive thinking persons now, and we're still an African American community. We're a minority community at Baltimore City College during that time. So my good friend, Sandy Rosenberg, who you know, right?
Cares a little bit about Pimlico.
Oh, my. He's a great guy. You know? Kurt Schmoke there, you know, right? This Kenneth Thompson, another brilliant.
Man, that's quite a room.
Yeah, these are now your peers. And we had the most amazing time growing up. And because of the nature of City, you had to be collegiate. You had to be dressed. You had to have a tie. We were impacted by our music figures. Our music figures, the Temptations.
Oh, nice.
All right.
Diana Ross coming in then.
Right. Smokey. And
the era of Berry Gordy,
and,
right?
Exactly. And when they went on stage, they were dressed to the T. So when we were in school, we reflected that. We were going to have.
You also saw it in television. You saw it in media. And you were going to emulate.
We were going to have polished shoes. We were going to have a
floor. Mother looked like George and Ringo.
But the Reverend was going to be David Ruffin.
That's right. I was going to be. No question. You would have an alpaca sweater.
There you go.
You would have your tie. And, I mean, you would go to school as if you were auditioning for a music choir. Now, that's the impact. Now, think about that in your formative stages. You think about that. In your formative stages, that one, you got this strong Afrocentric sense. You're able to now operate in a integrated community and not lose who you are, but develop friendships. And then you come to that you're now reflecting the best that you can in your dress and your deportment. I think if you look at our educational system now, you don't find any of those qualities.
Well, you were given a chance to prove yourself.
Exactly.
We're going to talk
exactly
about why you don't. I think it's a perfect time to.
I got to take a break. I'm going to be using his notebook over here. I want to take notes.
When we do come back, first of all, I want to thank our sponsors. But when we do come back, I do want to talk. I want to jump back to the neighborhood that you integrated. And I want to talk about how that neighborhood evolved.
All right.
And then this passion that comes up from you about education. You just alluded to it. We don't see that today, and we're going to talk about why that is. Nestor, once again, we thank Jennings, State Fair, Fadley's. Want to talk about, because I know the Reverend cares deeply about the Housing Equity Conference being sponsored by Center Maryland.
We're a part of that.
You're
going to
be,
you're going to be a
part of that.
So we call you Rev Al. I'm just going to call you the good doc.
The good doc.
Okay, that's
good doc.
Okay, that's fine. That's
so
right.
much
that's
to talk about. Nestor, we're going to a break.
My wife said if you said to me that I could call you Al, I'd have to play the pulse.
Right, I was going to say we'd have to put a bumper music on there.
I warned you this was going to be good.
We're going to come back with some food, right?
We got lasagna. I got pot roast.
Look at this.
All right.
I see the lasagna over there. I just can't get to it, but we'll get
we'll be right back.
We're at WNST Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. We are AM 1570. We're back from Catonsville and Jennings right after this.